dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. When the people of nations understand the actual reasons that motivate their rulers to send them to war, there will be fewer wars, and little need to create national holidays to commemorate all the people who died in them, more often than not, senselessly. On this Memorial Day weekend, right-wing talk radio and their entertainment-oriented cousins, the country music stations, are full of sentiment for those who died, quote, defending our freedom. Tonight on the program, we're going to hear some truth about that, about the military, and about the government's wham-bam, thank-you-ma'am attitude toward the people it sends to fight its wars. We're going to hear it from the mouths of a variety of veterans whose experience in the U.S. military has made them peacemakers.
No fat rich man's pony can overtake you. There's not a rider.
There's a saying that in a bacon and egg breakfast, the chicken is involved and the pig is committed. The speaker we're about to hear, Brian Wilson, epitomizes that level of commitment. A Vietnam veteran who survived that war in one piece, Brian later lost both his legs lying down on the tracks in an effort to stop a train carrying a shipment of weapons destined to kill peasants fighting U.S.-backed dictators in Central America. This speech was given in Los Angeles last April.
Well, I have been incredibly emotional for the last few months. I live up in a small town in Arcata, California, where every Friday our Veterans for Peace chapter vigils on the plaza in silence with the women in black to our in the other corner of the plaza. And the silence has been more healing to me than talking, and so I actually haven't been speaking that much. I've been, of course, reflecting and talking to lots of people in small groups. But I felt so emotional, I'm never sure what I'm going to be able to say and whether I'll be able to keep my composure. And to ground myself right now, I think I will just tell you how my initial awakening happened. I was, like Ron Kovic and so many others, I was just a regular guy, but I was from a small farming community of 350 people in upstate New York. And I thought that America was the greatest country in the history of the world. I, unlike Joel, didn't have any ambivalence. I was a total believer in everything that our government said, and my church said, that my parents said, that my school said, and it was a wonderful story. It was an incredible story. How could you complain about it? It was like a fairy tale. In fact, it is a make-believe story. But it took me a long time to figure it out. And the way it happened was, I happened to be in Vietnam in 1969, seemingly in a relatively safe position. I was an Air Force officer in charge of a security unit that was protecting an air base 100 miles south of Saigon. So I wasn't out in the boonies looking to kill people. We were defending ourselves from attacks. So we were always on the defensive. I had 40 men, and we had 10 machine guns. We had mortars. We were well defended. But my boss, who was a Vietnamese colonel, asked me to do an extra duty for him. He said that some of his South Vietnamese pilots were missing their targets. And I hadn't thought too much about the bombing and the targets. I'd only been there like 3 weeks. And I was basically very studiously studying intelligence reports to make sure that we could secure the base from attacks from all sides. And he said he wanted me to go with one of his lieutenants, whose name was Bo, a Vietnamese lieutenant who was educated in Mississippi, who spoke good English. And he wanted us to go, partly because his Jeep had been blown up and I still had my Jeep intact, and he needed somebody to go to these villages after the airstrikes and do a ground assessment of the bombings, of whether these targets had been hit or not. And the targets, it turns out, were villages. The very first village that we went to was in April of 1969. And I didn't know how to get to it, but Bo directed me on these dirt roads along the Bosak River. And we were there within 10 or 15 minutes of the end of the bombing. And this whole village had been virtually destroyed. It wasn't very difficult. They're like mounds in the rice paddies. There's no vegetation. There were no guns there. There was no defenses. It was 11 o'clock in the morning. And two planes or three planes could unload their few bombs and their napalm bombs and destroy everybody. So the scene I saw was probably about 120 corpses. Or bodies lying on the ground, and maybe 60 of them were dead. I couldn't tell for sure. But at my feet, there was a woman who was trying to hold three children. She'd obviously had been fleeing the bombing, and all of a sudden they were 2 feet from my feet, and her eyes were open, and I thought maybe she was alive, so I bent over. And I started crying. And of course they were dead, but the napalm had burned off their skin and their eyelids. And I was gagging. And Bo, this Vietnamese lieutenant, asked me what my problem was. And of course I had never been in this place before. This was a brand new place for me. Never have I ever experienced anything like this. I didn't have any plan. This was just what came out. And I said something in response to Bo's question, which has mystified me to this day, but it also has taken me into deep places of consciousness. I said, without even thinking, looking at these people on the ground, I said, "This is my family." Now, I was from a lower working class family in upstate New York. My father was a Fuller brush salesman. You know, there was no intellectual discussion in my family. There was no questioning going on. I don't know where that came from at that moment, except from some very ancient place that was a truth. Like, we really are all family. We are all part of the human family. And he laughed and said, "This was a victory. These were all communists." And it just didn't mean anything to me from that point on. It was just a worthless ideological conditioning. And I realized at that point, standing there, I was cognizant of not where that answer came from, but I was cognizant that I was no longer one of the good guys on the planet, and that I was, you know, I had a lot of karma that I had to deal with. I mean, it was really pretty unbelievable that I could have followed an order to go halfway around the world. I mean, and I know a lot of vets might feel this way, but this is really how I experienced it, because I had been a good student in my school. I had been valedictorian, honor society, student council. You know, I'm supposed to know something. I'm supposed to be able to ask questions. And I realized that I was very disabled. That was the word that came to me. I'm very disabled because I can't see. I haven't been trained to see. I just felt so unbelievably ashamed that I was standing in that village. It was not my village. It was these people's village. And I was 10,000 miles from my hometown. How could that be? So shortly thereafter, I happened to find a book in the library at my little airbase. The book was entitled The United States in Vietnam by Kahin and Lewis, two Cornell University professors. And I read that book, and I couldn't believe that I didn't know anything about the history of Vietnam or the French and the U.S. intervention in Vietnam. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that I was all the way over to Vietnam. I already had a master's degree. I was already a commissioned officer. I was 27 years old, and I didn't know anything about how the French Indochina War ended and how the United States sabotaged the peace, how we manufactured South Vietnam. We created a fiction, and then we brought Diem from the United States, from a Mary Knoll Seminary in New Jersey, to Vietnam to be our man. So that was an incredible moment. That all happened in like a week, where I was like, I was in shock that we were destroying systematically all these villages in the Mekong Delta. Every village was targeted. Every village was targeted for bombing. They would just do three or four every day. And so that was the beginning of my awakening. It wasn't maybe not a typical experience, but each Vietnam vet has a different experience and a different history. It just depends on where you were and when you were there and what you were doing. I spoke out against the war, of course, and I was sent home after 151 days with many court-martial charges against me, all for sedition. They even brought a lawyer from Canto City, an army lawyer, to read me my rights at this little airbase. I was just like, I mean, I was talking about Nuremberg. I was talking about Army Reg 2710 that says you're not supposed to kill civilians and civilian targets. I knew that much. It kind of came out like, wow, we're committing war crimes. That isn't what I came here to do. And then, of course, as I started studying history, I really did realize about the make-believe story of this civilization, how we stole the land at gunpoint, we stole the labor at gunpoint, and we stole the resources at gunpoint from all over the world. We have built an entire civilization on a lie, on a series of lies and pretexts that sound very noble, sound very, very rational and very justifiable. I spent many years traveling to Latin America and to the Middle East, studying the history and nature of U.S. policy, and I'd come home, and I would try to talk to my own family, and it was not possible. They could not comprehend the cruelty and the bellicosity of what the United States policies were doing, either overtly or covertly. I mean, it really is hard for people to grasp how incredibly demonic Western civilization has been, and not just the United States. And so we've been given a cosmic gift, I believe, in disguise with George Bush. I mean, really, 9/11 and Bush's response to it is like, I believe it's like a cosmic gift that's been given to us just in time to get it, to get that we have been really butchering the planet for centuries. We have been murdering people for centuries, most of us not even knowing it, not even thinking about it, don't even want to think about it. Why would you want to upset this fairy tale? I mean, it really was a wonderful story. It just wasn't true, and it isn't true. And this is, as Ron and others have said, this is a pivotal evolutionary moment in human history, and it is a moment both of dark peril and of incredible, unusual opportunity to, in a sense, undo and redo culture, Western culture at least. This is not just an anti-war movement. We have to build a justice movement, and we have to go beyond and articulate a vision for the alternative. And this vision, I don't think, includes nation-state structures. This vision includes taking our responsibility as human beings and letting our imaginations liberate our imaginations that have been so locked up for so long, very conditioned to fit certain patterns of life. Now we know that what our way of life will do will destroy the planet. We know it. You can see it right at the end of your nose. You can see that Western civilization is at its end, and that violence and war is going to kill not only our species, but, of course, many other species, and it already has. So we've learned something, and we've had 30 years of people talking about this demythologizing the make-believe version of our civilization. We've had Chomsky and Zinn and lots of other speakers and vets and ex-CIA agents who finally have been talking about, it took Vietnam, I think. It took the humiliation of Vietnam to our nation to open up in the psyche this willingness to begin telling the truth, this terrible truth. It's like, God, I didn't even want to acknowledge the truth for several years. It was so painful to realize, as I studied U.S. history, and as I studied world history, and then I studied anthropology to study the history of human evolution, and then I studied physics and got into quantum physics, trying to understand all the levels, all the dimensions of life. I studied Jungian psychology. Also was a patient, often, with Jungian psychiatrists, just in my own healing process, learning about my shadow and how shadows get projected on other people. And that works for nations too. Everything that we say about Iraq or Saddam Hussein is our own shadow. We're looking at the images of ourselves when we project them on others. So this is really is an extraordinary moment to be alive. As emotional as I have been feeling, I've actually felt, I told my therapist this, I feel like I'm in suspended animation, like my head is hanging in such a way that my artificial legs are dangling off the ground, and that my body's kind of in a quiver, and that I'm seeing two trains coming towards each other, the biological evolution and cultural evolution coming at breakneck speed for this big collision. And that I'm hoping that we, as human beings, especially in the West, especially in the United States, can create a new culture, a new consciousness that will at least cause a sideswipe rather than a head-on collision, so that we might actually survive whatever Bush is going to do. Maybe in the next 2 weeks there will be far more things happening in the movement in the United States that we can't even predict right at this moment, because things are happening so fast. And if you study chaos theory, you've probably heard about the butterfly effect. Basically, very small incidents can create huge implications that can't be predicted. The metaphor is the butterfly that flaps its wings in Brazil creates a tornado in Texas. That's how the physicists try to explain it. And if you study quantum physics, you realize that at the subatomic level, there's so many energy fields that we're all part of, that we have not even been, you know, we've been operating as if we're in this kind of Newtonian material world, but there's also the spiritual world. There's this new understanding of how the cosmos works and how we're all part of it, and we've been living as if we're separate from it. And so this paradigm shift is pretty staggering. It's pretty powerful, because it puts us back into harmony with the whole cosmos, the energy fields of the cosmos from which we've always been part of. And if sometimes people ask me, what is my vision of the future? And I say, well, I'm now living in a small farming community in Northern California, so I don't have to drive much. I cycle everywhere on my hand cycle, except I did drive to Los Angeles. And I don't like to fly, and that I'm trying to rediscover what it was like to live in a Neolithic village with Buddhist economics and appropriate technology kind of synthesized in a bioregion. So I have a bioregional address. It's the Mad River Watershed in northern Humboldt County, trying to actually conceptualize this manner in which we really are living with the earth. The mother is our teacher. Indigenous people are our teachers. Silence is our teachers. It's amazing to us vets that stand in silence on the plaza in this little arcata how much power we feel by standing in silence for just 1 hour a day. Just silently standing, just reflecting, just kind of in a meditation. These are kinds of dimensions of power and encouragement that put us in a place we haven't been before. And so I've been trying to be thanking the Great Spirit for this cosmic gift in disguise, even though I'm scared to death. The Patriot Act 2, which hasn't passed yet, makes the Patriot Act 1 real tame. It actually authorizes the Attorney General of the United States to identify people, U.S. citizens, as terrorists if he simply suspects that their activities are interfering with the war on terror. And it authorizes deportation of U.S. citizens. I don't know where they're going to deport them to, but it actually authorizes it in the new legislation. And the word that I get is that the legislation may be introduced whenever Bush decides to go to war or escalates the war. This is something that we really have to be together to resist and non-cooperate with this government in almost any way we can, including going on strikes, including tax resistance, including taking days off from work, taking days off from driving, taking your money out of the stock market if it's there. But basically, this empire can only function with our complicity. And it will only fall when we decide that we no longer will allow this government to exist. Now, Now, I'm not talking about violence. This is nonviolent. This is never giving them a reason to do what they did to me, for example. You know, I was shocked when I was in the hospital after being run over by the train, thinking I was going to go to jail, but not having any memory of actually being hit. And the first question from the investigator, with my lawyer present at my side, probably a week or 10 days into my hospitalization, the first question was, when did you plan to hijack, at what point did you start planning to hijacking the train? And I was like, hijack the train? Well, then I learned what had happened during the fast the year before. The four of us sitting on the steps drinking water for almost 7 weeks, we were, for some bizarre reason, considered by the government a threat. So they identified, the FBI identified us as suspects in a domestic terrorism inquiry. Now, we didn't know that at the time, but while we were fasting, Senator Warren Rudman, who at that time was a senator in New Hampshire, was quoted in the Boston Globe as saying that he likened the fasting veterans to Middle East terrorists. It was the first clue we had of how they were thinking. I have that Boston Globe headline in my scrapbook because it was such it was like, what is going on here? Well, then our office was broken into 2 days later and our records taken. We had a Veterans Fast for Life office. But we still weren't putting two and two together. It wasn't until after the investigator asked me when I was when I planned to hijack the train, and then we in the interviews with the train crew, they admitted that they had been ordered that morning not to stop the train under any circumstances because they expected us to board the train. And then a month later, somebody called me from Illinois and said there was an FBI agent that had just been fired for refusing to investigate the Veterans Fast for Life as terrorists. His name is Jack Ryan. He's another hero. He's another one of these unsung heroes. He lost his job after almost 22 years in the FBI. He took his case to the Supreme Court and lost. But then Jack Ryan turned over the orders that he had been given so that we had a copy of the orders that had been submitted to him and many other agents to investigate us fasters as terrorists. And that was the reason I lost my legs, because they had in their minds that we were terrorists, or at least that I was a terrorist, and one other veteran that was with me on the tracks had also been part of that fast. So there were two terrorists in their minds, and I guess they just, their paranoia goes, as we know, it does, it goes crazy and goes wild. So when I read the Patriot Act 2, I think, gee, I was called a terrorist under Reagan for sitting on the steps drinking water. Of course, we were protesting Reagan's policies in Central America, but it was a staggering thing to realize that when people would say, well, at least you have the freedom to demonstrate in the United States and protest. And I said, yeah, but I didn't think I'd lose my legs for doing it. And it's like, oh, they hadn't thought of that. Maybe the freedom isn't quite that crystal clear. So at any rate, this is a perilous time. We have been given a government. Actually, if Gore had been president, which is his legal right, we wouldn't be in this. But we wouldn't be where we're at, because Gore is a friendly fascist. And Bush is a real bold one. He really says it clearly. There's no masking now. It's all out there. We are premeditating mass murder against the world, if so inclined, depending on the day, Iraq's first, with the use of nuclear weapons. And they're now talking about their new e-bomb, they call it. What is it? Yeah, this is, it's a, it, it put, it, it knocks out all electricity. It knocks out every radio, it knocks out every line with one blast of voltage. And I suppose they figured out how to do it without interrupting their own electronic communications. They're usually that smart, I guess. Maybe not. But actually, since life is so unpredictable, nobody knows what's going to happen. But we do know that we have a duty, an obligation, a responsibility as human beings. We've been on a 7 million year evolutionary journey as a bipedal species. We have everything we've created, nation states, armies, male dominator roles, hierarchies, oligarchies. We created them, our species. We chose to create them, and we also chose to be complicit with them and to, in some ways, go along. Maybe because there was a lot of force involved. Maybe there was a lot of guns involved pointed at us. But in some way, we have all been complicit with this model. And the model I just described goes back 5, 6, 7,000 years. This is not even new to what we call Western civilization. Male dominator, oligarchic, bureaucratic, hierarchic, violence. This is an old model with the masses going along at gunpoint as the laborers. Well, we now know that is going to end if we are going to continue as a species. So we know we've learned a lot. We have this capacity now to create our separation, our liberation, our breaking free from the model that we all grew up in, believing in. We now know that model is going to destroy us all. And by the way, I do believe that Bush's policies are inevitable if the American way of life wants to continue as it is. I mean, it is true that what Bush is proposing is necessary if the American way of life wants to continue business as usual, under the delusion, of course, that it could go on forever. So that's why I think it's a blessing that we've been given this bold, cruel, incredibly criminal position that's stated so boldly that we can't miss it. I mean, a lot of people now can't miss it. It's just, I thought I was dumb in Vietnam. And when I read that book, I couldn't believe that I didn't know anything about Vietnam or why we were there, except we were fighting communists. Now we know that the American way of life, I call AWOL, really does require stealing everything at gunpoint. We have to have everything to maintain this incredible, insatiable, consumptive way of life, which is a crime against nature in and of itself. So coming to grips, all of us coming to grips with this huge historic paradigm shift is our challenge. It goes way beyond stopping the war with Iraq. It begins with building a justice movement. And it goes beyond that by articulating what is a sustainable model. We are totally capable of doing uncreating what we created and creating something totally different because our survival requires it. It's our responsibility if we want to continue living. So I certainly do vacillate between being scared and being totally awestruck at this moment in history. But when I'm with other people, like here and in Arcata, where I think 60% of the voters in Arcata voted for Peter Camejo for Green, governor of California. This is a time, as Ron said and others said, this is an incredible time. And I want to say, is leading into the film, I got interested in Korea because I had been in Vietnam, and after I discovered that Vietnam was a fraud, I started going back and looking at all the other wars. And the first war I, of course, went to was Korea because it was only 10 years before Vietnam. And I discovered, we brought Syngman Rhee from the United States over to South Korea in 1945 to be our ruler in South Korea, which we insisted on occupying after the Japanese defeat And all the Koreans, virtually all the Koreans except the wealthy Koreans that had worked with the Japanese, who had occupied Korea for 40 years, they were in opposition to the United States. The U.S. troops came in on September 8, 1945. Korea had announced its new sovereignty on September 2nd, 6 days earlier, same day that Ho Chi Minh announced independence for Vietnam. And I thought, wow, here's all these people trying to have their own life, and these Western powers insisting on continuing these old patterns, which are required if we want to continue living an exploitive life, because we really do need to have these areas where we steal. This is the part that my parents just couldn't get. And I understand, it's tough. It's a tough reality. It's shocking to realize that 4.5% of the world's population have been consuming 40% of the world's resources at gunpoint. How else do you steal like that? You have to steal it with a gun in people's face. And I have to always say I'm so sorry to the Vietnamese and to the Nicaraguans and to the Salvadorans and all the other places that the United States has been, where I have visited. I really feel tremendous grief for this pain and suffering that we created for people that are far more authentic, I believe, than I was in Vietnam. I realize I'm really not a very authentic person. I'm kind of an ideological robot. These people were in their villages where they had been for hundreds of years. So we have this moment of reckoning. And if this moment really continues to unfold as it has been in the last few months, we can't predict just how incredibly powerful we are to say we're taking our power back. We are not cooperating. Even if you take off my arm, I'm not going to cooperate. Even if I have to go to prison, or if you want to deport me, I can't agree with what you're doing. It's against my own nature. Just one more thing about Korea. When I kept studying U.S. history in Korea, some of you might have heard about the Taft-Katsura Agreement. It was 1905. It was an agreement between the U.S. Secretary of State, Taft, and the Japanese Foreign Minister, Katsura. And it was an agreement at the end of the Russo-Japanese War that the Japanese had almost won, but they asked Teddy Roosevelt, to intervene to end the conflict. Well, the United States had recently taken the Philippines during the Spanish-American War and after the Spanish-American War, and that was considered in Japanese territory. So there was a deal made in 1905 that we, the United States, would let Japan have Korea if we could have the Philippines unimpeded. That was the first real assault on the Korean people, who had been unified for 5,000 years as a single culture. And I thought, wow, I've got to keep going back and studying this history. I've got to go back to the Mexican-American War. I've got to go back to the War of 1812. I've got to go to the Revolutionary War. I've got to look at the Founding Fathers. I've got to look at all these Puritans and look at their statements going back to the 1600s. What was it going on here on this continent? There was something quite different than the story that we all were told. Read some of the early Puritan statements about the indigenous. It's pretty disgusting. The arrogance and the ethnocentrism and the racism that have dominated our culture have been almost beyond comprehension for most of our citizenry. It is very deep. And it makes it very easy to go all over the world and pluck the fruit and then say you're civilizing people. You're bringing them Christianity and you're relieving them of their resources that they don't know how to deal with. So I met Mickey Grant when I saw his film Coochie Tunnels. I saw it at a film festival. I didn't know Mickey, but it was the first film I'd seen of the Vietnam War from the Vietnamese perspective, from the Viet Cong perspective, with U.S., with English subtitles. And I was so impressed with the film, I went up and introduced myself to Mickey at the film festival, and I said, boy, that's the first time I've really seen a film that talks about the war from the perspective of the Viet Cong. And we started talking, and the next thing we knew, we decided that we wanted to make films disclosing the hidden history of the United States. And the first film we took on was The Hidden History of U.S. and Korea, because it's so relevant to how the North Koreans think today and why there is so much animosity in the South against the United States that's not reported in the Western press. I've been over there 8 times. We've interviewed hundreds of people, both in the North and the South, survivors of massacres that happened 50 years ago. So this has all become just, you know, part of my learning in this lifetime about the history of my government and my culture, and in some way, I guess, trying to make atonement for the fact that I was so ignorant. I was so ignorant that I followed orders to go across the ocean to participate in murdering people that I didn't know anything about or anything about their history. Now, that is an incredible feat. And that dynamic has been going on for several thousand years in different empires, big and small. But it didn't make me feel any better after I recognized it. It's like, how could that happen? Where was my soul? Where has been our soul? Where is our soul? I'm hoping that what we are going to see in the next week, next month, next year, next decade, is we are going to discover our soul. And our soul connects us with everything and everybody. Deep. It goes deep. Very deep. And if we find our soul, we find our health. And we find our health and soul, we find our power. And we can do whatever that voice is suggesting we do, because we're now connected with the awesome power of the cosmos. I don't mean to be spacey, but this is physics, cosmology, theology, psychology, that's all converging to understand the interconnectedness of everything and the sacredness of everything, including us. So, finally, I want to say that there's been a Korean in Los Angeles area recently arrested as a spy. He was a store owner. It's a ridiculous story. But a lot of the Koreans that were going to be here today are so terrified to come out in public to a political event that they would not come. And let's hope that those of us that are Eurocentric don't let our Eurocentric white male leaders intimidate us so that we stay home. Or actually, people, whatever you need to do, just do it. But let's help each other overcome any intimidation we might feel, including myself. I must say, I need help too to continue on this course. So, with that, I want to conclude my remarks in saying I'm thankful that I've survived this experience, because I am an emotional wreck these days, and we do have, Frank and Don are going to say something, and then for those who want, we have pictures, slides from Vietnam that start telling our story. Thank you for bearing with me.
That was Vietnam veteran and peace activist Brian Wilson. He spoke last April in Los Angeles. Thanks to the LA Sound Posse for that tape.
It could have been Manhattan on the day the market fell. And it could have been a candy store in Kandahar as well. And she might have been a Muslim, but it's kind of hard to tell. When your body's ground to zero and your skin's been fried to hell. So tell me it's a war to end all war, or don't tell me nothing.
as if this sacrifice is not for peace, it was not worth making. Seemed to me you did your best to put your hand in the hornet nest that bit you just when it hit you. There's other people hurt as much as you, and grief is no excuse for what you do. High flyers at the corporation's daisy cutting edge, they hold each other's hands and plummet from the window ledge. And the monitors have mounted on the coffee deal, which meant 5,000 farmers wondering where their livelihood just went. America, my family, the whole world feels your pain, and before this war is over, you'll make sure we do again. Even as the tower tumbled on that firefighting team, we wondered who you'd barbecue for puncturing your dream. So tell me it's a war to end all war, or don't tell me nothing. 'Cause if this sacrifice does not bring peace, it was not worth making. Seemed to me you did your best to put your hand in the hornet nest that bit you, but it still don't hit you. There's other people feel as much as you, and freedom's no excuse for what you do. I am not an Islamicist, religion's not my thing, but they're friendlier than Christians, and I like the way they sing. And I want my sisters free to burn the burqa if they choose, not lie awake and calculate what weight they need to lose. So tell me it's a war to end all war, or don't tell me nothing. 'Cause if this sacrifice don't change the world, it was not worth making. Seemed to me you did your best to put your hand in the hornet nest that bit you. When will it hit you? There's other people need as much as you, and greed is no excuse for what you do. You're beautiful, big-hearted, in many ways you're free, and you're smart enough to get the world how you want it to be. So it's hard for me to tell you what you shouldn't have to hear. Your nation is that terrorist most human beings fear. Nicaragua, El Salvador, Colombia, and now Cambodia, Grenada, Chile, and Afghanistan. Palestinian and Iraqi, and some more you never knew. United States of people who deserved as much as you. So tell me that you don't support this war, or don't tell me nothing. 'Cause if this song of mine don't change your heart, it was not worth singing. But I believe you did your best, chasing life and happiness. Never wondered, never guessed how the news had been suppressed of a never-ending killing fest. Ripped the kid from the mama's breast, shrapnel through her daddy's chest, while we're all singing glory, hallelujah. I'm talking to you. Somebody made a killing in your name, so take your power back or take the blame.
The experience of the veterans of the 1991 Persian Gulf War illustrates how cynically the U.S. government and its military operate. Many of the people who ended up fighting in that war were only in the military or the reserves to get training or college money. They did not expect to be in combat. Though few died on the actual battlefield, thousands have since died, and about one-third of that 600,000-person force are disabled by mysterious medical conditions believed to be caused by a combination of depleted uranium exposure, vaccinations, and various toxics on the battlefield. The military has attempted to deny the service-related nature of their illnesses, especially with regards to the depleted uranium, because if they admitted its toxic nature, they would have to stop using it. And they love it, because it's very effective at killing, and it's a great boon to the nuclear power industry as a way to get rid of nuclear waste by leaving it lying around on the ground in a variety of distant lands. Next, we're going to present some excerpts from a forum, Vets Speak Out, Depleted Uranium and the Gulf War Syndrome, that took place in April in Seattle.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Ellen Murphy. I have the distinct honor of welcoming you here tonight and giving a little introduction. And I think the reason, I guess, that I've been given that honor is that I had an experience in Bellingham for Veterans Day in which I distributed information about depleted uranium at the recruiting center and was arrested for criminal trespass. And well, it was a 3-day trial. I was convicted, and we are going to appeal it. But the wonderful thing is that out of that trial has come a tremendous amount of communication. The thing that thrilled me more than anything was that I started getting calls from veterans. Veterans who felt that the action and the resulting trial was giving them a voice. The wilderness isn't only in the countries that we make war on. The wilderness is here in our own country. And so our veterans are coming forth, and their voices from the wilderness as well. So we will have some veterans here tonight who will speak from the heart and what I've experienced as a counselor and therapist. And it says on the program I'm a veteran counselor. Not quite true. I'm a chemical dependency counselor, and I have worked with many veterans over the years. And that's why I chose Veterans Day to do the action, because it was the only way that I could think of, the best way to honor veterans for Veterans Day was to warn them about the toxic battlefield that we left there and that we're making even more toxic now. You'll hear much more about that as the night goes on. So when people speak from their heart, it's a sacred space. We're in a church already, which I presume to be a sacred space in its own way, but I think what really makes a sacred space is when people speak from their heart. And then I just had a couple of comments I wanted to make about the fact that this is nothing new, the toxic battlefield, and I know that you all know that. Most people do know that. That back in the 43 to 63, there were 300,000 military personnel who, without their knowledge or consent, were exposed to incredibly high amounts of radiation. They had to fight for their rights, too. They had to form organizations, the Atomic Veterans Association, radiation victims, all kinds of organizations. And then there were the vets, tens of thousands of vets exposed to Agent Orange. And now we have 400,000 who were exposed to depleted uranium, so-called depleted uranium, in the Gulf War. So it's nothing new. And when I think, you know, about DU, that's something that's often been used against the vets by the Veterans Administration and the Pentagon. It means diagnosis unsubstantiated. So let's change DU to not divide, which is the D, but unite, which is the U. Now it is my distinct pleasure to introduce to you Alvin Clark, our first speaker. He is six years Army, 7 years National Guard, 8 months Desert Storm active duty. He's originally from South Carolina. Now he lives in Tacoma. He's married to Anita and has his 3 children, Carmel, Benny, and Sean. And I am very honored to introduce Alvin.
First of all, I thank God for being here, and I thank the people that had invited me to be here to speak tonight as a veteran. As was told, I spent 8 months at Desert Storm. I was stationed at the Port of JaVale, and my job was transportation. So we were responsible for the soldiers getting their supplies, their vehicles, their food, and anything else that they needed. I went over there as a healthy young soldier. I came back a totally different soldier. I got sick immediately when I got back, and I stayed sick. I got back in June of 1991, and I stayed sick until they did something, until 1994. And when I say sick, I mean sick. I almost died. They sent me to numerous places to get tested. They sent me to Walter Reed. They sent me to Bethesda, Maryland, and nobody could find out what was wrong. And in the meantime, I was getting sicker and sicker. My family didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to do. And the Army didn't know what to do. So, in the meantime, I was getting sicker, and I had a doctor that was stationed at Madigan Hospital that decided that the only thing that was left to do was a bone marrow transplant. In the meantime, the Army didn't want to pay for my sickness. The National Guard didn't want to pay for my sickness because I was active duty when I went over there. And I'm just here to say that it's so much goes on behind the scene that we as people don't see. If you hadn't been there to go through it, or if you hadn't actually met someone that have went through it like myself, then you don't know what you are missing. I had to fight. I was investigated. My family was sent through turmoil. They thought I was trying to get Army money from the military or from the government. And in the meantime, I'm dying. So the things sometimes that you see on the outward appearance is not necessarily what's behind the scene. My family had to go through, my wife had to take off 8 months from work to take care of me. After the bone marrow transplant, I had a relapse and had to go back into the hospital. I almost died. In fact, they say I did die on the table, I mean in my bed. But I'm here today because of the grace, the prayers, and the support of people that really care. Now that's not everybody, because everybody really don't care for the soldiers. It's just a known fact. I'm a living witness of that. But the people need to wake up. We as people, we as soldiers' families, we need to wake up and look at what's behind the scene and not just what you see with your natural eye. Because everything that you see with your natural eye is not really what's going on. Things happened to me over there. We was in stuff that y'all couldn't see. I'm quite sure some of you might have family over there now. I have family over there in the war that's going on right now. I know they can't email me. I know they can't write and tell me everything that's going on because I couldn't do it. But we need to really look, because what you see on TV is not necessarily what's actually going on. I've been there. I know.